Eight of the 10 leading U.S. product brands are American. More than half the sales of each of these brands are outside the United States. The Financial Times reports that some of the world's strongest consumer brands, like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Gap, are being hit hard. Coca-Cola sales in Germany dropped 16% from the similar period last year. McDonald's is in crisis. Disney World in Paris is bankrupt. GM and Ford in Germany are about to close, and so on, so on. Now, this is not good news if you want to strengthen your economy by more export. There's much more to come. And I'm not going to report all of that. I'm just going to say that this is not an organized boycott. It's much worse. It is a feeling of disgust. And this feeling of disgust makes Coca-Cola taste bad. There are medical reasons for that. An idiotizing, fattening, tepid, seeping liquid. But leaving those aside, this feeling is spreading. In order to understand that feeling better, we have to look at those data that you all know, more or less, about how did people vote when they were asked, how would you vote if you were an American and were participating in the elections today? Well, you have probably seen it. It's reported. It is a world map with the votes, and it's correctly made, red and blue. It's a strange distribution of colors. We are not used to that one in Europe that way, but anyhow, we can take many things. Of all the countries outside Europe on this map, there were three countries favorable to Bush. The other ones were all favorable to ABB. And the countries favorable to Bush were Poland, the Philippines, and Nigeria. India was about equal. Now, Poland and Philippines have one thing in common with Bush. Together with America, those are the countries that get the highest score if you add up the number of people who believe in God and the number of people who believe in Satan. If you do that for the U.S., you have to add 94 and 71, and you get, of course, 165. If you take similar processes for Poland and Philippines, you get about the same. But the U.S. is number one in believing in Satan. There's no other country in the world that believes that much in Satan. And in the Chicago Tribune's report, which was reported in the Yomiuri Shimbun in Japan the 3rd of January this year, it is pointed out very clearly that by Satan, the pollsters made it very clear it's somebody who is on full-time duty and interferes in your daily life. Now, Michael Moore's point that Americans are a frightened race, I think, misses a point. It misses the theological underpinning. So what I am saying that I can explain Philippines and Poland theologically, and you should not see it as political allegiance. So, I take it as a theological statement. Nigeria, I simply don't understand. So, India can understand. Was a Thai, the common enemy of Muslims. That, I think, makes some kind of political sense. And has, of course, been the Bush administration's effort to circumvent the alliance formation between Russia, India, and China. An alliance formation which eventually will cost the U.S. very dearly. Well, having said this, I am saying that the sentiment is of such a kind that people are not going to buy American goods. That means the export market is limited to what governments buy because they don't dare boycott because they might be bombed. Whereas a private guy who passes Esso, Texaco, Mobil, and not to forget Shell, and just goes on to the local pump, it's very difficult to bomb him. So the way they do it with governments is to more or less coerce them to buy arms. In order to be able to sell arms, you have to produce insecurity first. At that, the U.S. can be relied upon for producing the insecurity that at least stimulates the arms trade. But having said that, even the most lapdog-inclined government starts understanding the trick now. Resistance builds up. So having said that, I have mentioned difficulty with method number one in handling the weak dollar. What's method number two? You could do it with a very simple decree. You change the dollar bill overnight, and anybody who has old dollars, goodbye. If you want to redeem your bonds, try come and get it. In other words, it may be that those bonds can be written off as a loss. 92% of the U.S. deficit is covered by foreigners. 60% of it is covered by Asian countries, essentially Japan and China. Japan and China are covering the wars of the United States of America in order to guarantee their export markets, to make U.S. solvent enough to pay for the products they buy. Well, there is, of course, yet another method, which is to say, not only we export more, or we change the currency and you're not going to get it anyhow. And the third one would be to import less. Now, try that with an impoverished American working class to deprive them of Chinese goods. Cheap East Asian goods. I don't think that is very workable. So imagine you screw the working class, you shift the wealth upward to the top 20% or 1% for that matter. You have the consumer price index rise more than the salary index, the wages index rises. You make the situation deteriorate, like the data show. So what do you pay people when you don't pay them dollars? Well, you can pay them Jesus currency. You can say that believe in Jesus and God will protect us against. You can also pay them cheap Chinese goods. So imagine you cut off that possibility. Well, then you're left with Jesus currency. This is another method called redistribution. It's not being to be done by the Bush administration. The country is in a squeeze. The basic point about economic boycott is not the decline in profit. The basic point is the moral challenge. That will get to the USA the way it did to South Africa. US companies abroad make an average profit of 6%. That means a 6% boycott is sufficient to make them reconsider their overseas investment. And that's the magnitude we have for the brands I mentioned. Some will ask for U.S. military intervention. But since this is done by private people and not by governments, it's not easy. South Africa was in that situation, and both Mandela and the last white president told me that what hit us and what worked was not the boycott of apples, that was not important for our economy at all, but it was the moral message, the message of disgust. Foreign students coming to U.S. went down 2.4% last year. There are many interpretations. One of them is U.S. foreign policy. My wife and I passed into Los Angeles Airport 2 days ago, fingerprinting on both index fingers, and the iris scrutinized by some interesting device. I did not like it, and I say it with no smile. I didn't like it at all. So, let's go down the list. I mentioned the distribution and through with the economic factors. Let me take the next list, which is Ford, and those are the military contradictions. So by contradiction, we mean that the U.S. is pushing in one direction, and lo and behold, there is a counter-push. Contradiction number four, and this is a list that I made in 1999 and made public in 2000 with a prediction that the U.S. empire is gone by year 2025. You'll remember my boasting of my Soviet prediction. Bush was elected in year 2000, and I reduced it by 5 years after having watched him for a couple of months and defined him as a so-called accelerator of the synergies and the synchronies. He is now re-elected. I have reduced it by 5 more years. So we are now down to your 2015. Between, number four is between U.S. state terrorism and terrorism. It is almost unbelievable that an elite can believe that you can behave the way, kill that many people, and there will be no reaction. It doesn't work that way. So let us say that you multiply by every person killed by U.S. forces by a factor of 10. The number of friends, family, those who are bereaved and feel something in their heart. A sting. So suddenly you're up to not 12 to 16 million, but 150 million. It's rather unbelievable that some of those 150 million, for instance, 19 Arabs, shouldn't get the idea of doing something about it. And yet my interpretation of 9/11 is somewhat deeper than pure revenge. My interpretation of 9/11 is the public execution of two buildings, not the people in it. I don't think that was important to them. I think it was the buildings, for having sinned against Allah, for having intervened militarily, established bases with Jews and Christians in them. And on top of that, for having foisted upon a Wahhabite Saudi Arabia a consumerist lifestyle that they did not see as theirs. So if you look at it this way, it looks like we are caught in a vicious cycle between terrorism and state terrorism. How does that work right now? I mentioned that 5 countries were pulling out of the coalition of the willing. They have become unwilling. 6 countries in NATO have refused to train Iraqi officers. The numbers 5 and 6 will grow quickly. I don't have time to go into that. I'm just saying that the prediction is that the U.S. will be very alone. It's going badly. And that means that those who love the U.S. Republic are interested in how do we help U.S. get out. We are not concerned with getting out with honor. We are not concerned with that. But getting out in a way that in one sense teaches the U.S. a lesson, but in the other sense does something much more important. An Iraq that could function. I'll tick off points. By countries like Japan and European Union establishing contact with the Iraqi resistance, with the aim of having a conference for security and cooperation in the Middle East after the model of the Helsinki Conference, United States as an observer, and as a possible point on the agenda, an Iraqi federation with Kuwait as an associated member, independent country, as a federation with democracy and human rights. But the Kurds, who right now are the ones who have benefited from what has happened, having their part. The Sunnis having their part, but giving up the idea of being the instrument through which foreigners can run Iraq. And the Shias having an Islamic Republic in their part, but giving up the idea of running all of Iraq, according to that pattern. Now the key to this is a federation. The obvious precondition is very simple. All foreigners out. All the decrees made by the U.S. administration and puppet administration declared null and void. You start from the beginning with a free Iraq. It's a tall bill. When Iraq is mentioned, the word Vietnam often comes up. I remember so clearly in the 1970s, where everybody said that if the U.S. withdraws, there will be civil war and chaos in Iraq, in Vietnam. They managed it extremely well. I go on to the next one, which is United States relative to the Allies. Well, the Allies are falling off, and they are rather important countries. We are right now, of course, mainly talking about Germany, France, Spain. And I could go through the rest of the list and make some predictions. Number six is Russia, India, China. This could be the seat of the Fourth World War that Norman Podoritz is writing about in commentary in the September issue. They are coming closer than ever. The U.S. had a chance as long as the BJP was in power in India, because the BJP had given up two of Nehru's dictums, secularism and non-alignment. They went in for Hindutva and were contemplating a NATO for Asia with the United States. They lost the elections, to a large extent for that reason. That was not captured by the mainstream press. Well, as I said, 40% of humanity. United States is 6%. If you now go on to number seven, NATO versus the European Union army. This is not necessarily to say that it is an independence declaration of the United States, which of course it is. But it's also to say that the European Union should be watched as a possible imperial successor. I'm afraid of that one. But for the United States, it means that there is an alternative source, and that countries, one after the other, will leave NATO, not formally but informally, and go to the European Union. Let me just add that of the 25 countries that Germany had occupied and brutalized during the Second World War, 18 are members of the European Union together with Germany. That's quite something. United States will have to revise quite a lot of textbooks, which was the German approach, in order to create friends among the countries they have brutalized. Number eight, United States, United Nations. That it is tense, we know. The rift between UN and the US will not only be France, it will be much more universal. Okay. Number 10, 11, 12 are cultural contradictions. Judaism, Christianity on the one side against Islam. There are 1.3 billion Muslims. And they have this unfortunate habit of not accepting the borders that we have been drawing in the sand of the desert and things of that type. It's high time we learned that. But leaving that point aside, the tragedy of this religious divide, of religion so similar with so much beauty in all three of them, mobilizing the fundamentalists on both sides, where the U.S. union of Jewish and Christian fundamentalism is intellectually brilliant, as far as I've understood it, reading Rapture books and other books. And once being visiting professor at the University of Virginia and Duke University, and each week traveling between Duke and University of Virginia, passing through Lynchburg. Now, the name is not very promising, but the cafeteria conversations are fantastic. And they brought me up to date with Armageddon each time I bought a hamburger. And I was willing to buy more than one hamburger in order to be in on biblical time. What I found, incidentally, in a footnote, was that my distinguished American colleagues didn't know their own country. They were living in some ghettos called Harvard and Yale and California, Berkeley and places like that. Not the slightest contact with their own country. Okay, Lynchburg prevailed. But leaving that aside, how did the Jews and the Christians come together as fundamentalists? As far as I understand, by abolishing the old contradiction between not accepting Jesus as Messiah on the Jewish side and seeing Jesus as God's Son on the Christian side. And the formula was simple. The second coming of Jesus Christ is the first coming of Messiah. absolutely brilliant from the point of view of engineering a coalition. But it leaves out Islam. Anybody who can build bridges between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam deserves more than one Nobel Peace Prize. Now, these bridges are attempted built in this European Union OIC flirtatious exercise, and it will, of course, take place. But the European Union, at the same time, has very close cooperation with ASEAN, and they are silently, softly fomenting an East Asian community of the Mahayana Buddhist Confucian countries, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, China, Taiwan, of course, maybe Vietnam. In 1999, they had the first conference. Why is there a Western European community and not an East Asian community? I'm not going into the debate. I'll just say, new things are coming. And these are among the things that U.S. resents most, an East Asian community. Now, dear Washington, there's a handwriting on the wall. Read it. Don't try to fight it. It'll come, whatever you do. If you try to resist it, it'll come a little bit sooner. Join it. Welcome it. And maybe one day there will be not only one euro, but one Asia as a currency. Maybe one day there will be a global currency, but it will not be dollar. That will not be the global currency. Its days are past. They have peaked. Now, having said that, there are two others that are not so significant but important. There are other civilizations that feel trampled upon by the U.S., not only Islam. It is Hinduism. It is Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism in China. It is the Andean civilizations, the Inca, the Mexican Aztecs, the Mayas. There are grumblings and rumblings in all those places. And the signals are nothing good for Washington. This is, of course, also true for number 12, the European elite culture. The tremendous strength of U.S. culture has been its vulgarity, its guaranteed plebeian nature. It's reaching everybody. But that not in an evil sense of the vulgarity of the Coca-Cola and the hamburger, but also its universalism and generosity and its way of embracing everybody if they're willing to play the game the way it has been defined by the U.S. This is a weak one. The contradictions that are most important are growth versus distribution, productive versus finance economy, economy versus nature, terrorism versus state terrorism, U.S. versus Russia, India, China, U.S. versus UN, U.S. versus European Union, Judaism, Christianity versus Islam, and the world opposition. Now, the biggest demonstration in human history was, of course, the 12 million people, the 15th of February last year, in 600 places in the world, organized by the World Social Forum, Porto Alegre, Bombay. To have 12 million people come out in 600 places and then be wiped off the historical screen by Bush saying these are focus groups. The conclusion drawn by people all over the world is that the U.S. is not going to listen to words. Other languages have to be used. The solution of speaking with violence is not one generally accepted. Economic boycott then becomes a natural way of doing it. Okay, if you don't listen, we are not going to take you on and in. In that there is a message, and you will read it. Sooner or later it'll come to you. How does this work now in practice? Well, I'll tell you a little story from my own family. When I was 15, 1945, my sister and her coming husband had been fighting very much against the German occupation, like we all did, I was almost peeing in my pants, carrying illegal papers to school, distributing to another guy and things of that kind. She came back, having barely managed to escape to Sweden, came back in October 45, to the great delight of my parents and myself. And they announced, "We have become communists." I did not quite understand what this communist stuff was, but I asked my sister, "Why are you, what was it again, communist?" And she said, "For two reasons. The war against Nazi Germany was not won by England and America. It was won by the Soviet army. They were the ones who sacrificed. What the Anglo-Americans did was to kill, kill, kill in bombing. Point two, Soviet Union is the only country that has taken the bottom of society seriously and attended to their health and education and so on. And I had learned something about dictatorship, so I said that, having been through the war." And she said, "Yes, that's true, but that's only a phase." Okay, so now the following happened. The first book denouncing the Soviet Union and revealing the truth of Stalinism was by a Ukrainian called Igor Kravchenko, who became a refugee in Canada. And his book was called I Chose Freedom. Now, remember now that this was long before Solzhenitsyn. And you must see me as a 15-year-old boy. And I'm now observing my beloved sister. She took that book and threw it in the wall. Bang! Whereupon she picked it up and started reading. Phase one, total denial. It's all lies. Phase two, this Kravchenko is a traitor. It's probably paid by somebody. Phase three, okay, there is something to it. But it's only because of Stalin. We get rid of Stalin and everything will be okay. Phase four, okay, it was not only Stalin, something in the structure was wrong. One party, dictatorship for the proletariat. Okay, phase five. The whole idea was wrong around the beginning. And then comes quite often phase six, blind anti-Sovietism, totally incapable of appreciating some of the good things they did, like supporting anti-colonial war. About all of these, you can ask question marks, and there's a yin and a yang, and a yin and a yang to the yin, and a yang and a yin to the yang, and you di-di-di-di-di. And all of that is complicated once you start analyzing it. But I lived through these faces in two persons I loved. I see exactly the same all over Europe now in relation to the United States. The really U.S. philiacs will deny every sentence in what I have just said. Next phase, I'm a traitor. That's probably because he didn't get the position. He wanted to get foreign minister, and fortunately he is not. So that's the reason why he talks the way he did. Look, I'm totally satisfied with the power that I have in the world, and I wouldn't like it decreased by becoming foreign minister in a small country. Now, point three. This is not about the U.S., it's about Bush. And if we could only get rid of Bush, everything would be okay. Now, and if you have been protected by lack of knowledge about the country you have adored and which has so many adorable characteristics, as I have mentioned, the U.S. Republic, then you don't know that Kerry might even in some regards have been worse. Point four, there's something wrong in the whole structure. And up comes the anti-capitalist critique, up comes the anti-Pentagon, anti-military critique. Point five, there's something wrong in the whole culture. And that's when you start looking at this chosen people kind of business. My friends, what's happening now around the world is that people are going through these stages. And they go through them quickly. I think it's important that it doesn't end in blind anti-Americanism. And I can add one point to that. Israel has been playing the tail wagging the dog with the United States with considerable success. If you look at the things that they have done in this period, including shooting at American warships, including spying on America, and this suddenly becomes joint, common, accepted intellectual property of the whole U.S. population. You would be in for an anti-Semitism in the U.S. like nothing you've seen before. I think one way of averting that is honesty and try to take this terrible problem of a blind anti-Americanism and a blind anti-Semitism by simply changing course. Now, this is, of course, a not very well-veiled message to Mr. Sharon. You are on a blind alley, my friend, which leads but to death. And there is a very possible solution. Imitate the European community, make a Middle East community. Become member of the family. You may not like Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, recognize Jordan and Egypt, but these are your neighbors. Make it a family. The Europeans managed it. You can do it too. But don't try to boss them. The Germans were told for the first 20 years you don't say a word and you pay all the bills. They were told by the French, who have a relatively high level of arrogance. I don't think anybody's going to tell Israel that. But if Israel wants peace, that's the way. Washington helped them doing that. And don't play the present game. Now, if you manage these two things, both blind anti-Americanism and blind anti-Semitism might melt. So I stop at that point, and the debate starts. Thank you.
That was Johann Galtung speaking November 22, 2004 at UC Santa Barbara on the decline and fall of the American Empire. This talk is a production of the LA Sound Posse and is dedicated to the public domain. The LA Sound Posse recognizes the urgent need for the creation of a participatory civic media and so works to produce and teach others to produce public domain media that can be used by anyone for any purpose, including, most importantly, sharing it with friends and neighbors. We can be reached on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville in North Carolina.
My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side's adaptation of Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger. This program is produced at KPFT for Free Radio Santa Cruz, Community Radio, LPFM, and Micro Power stations worldwide. When we left Satan, vacationing in a medieval Austrian village, he had taken to altering the lives of the village folk, doing them service and favors, but his interference always seemed to lead to an untimely death for his beneficiaries, who were saved years of misery and sickness, but dead nevertheless. Both funerals took place at the same time in our little church next day. Everybody was there, including the party guests. Satan was there too, which was proper, for it was on account of his efforts that the funerals happened. Nicholas had departed this life without absolution, and a collection was taken up for the masses to get him out of purgatory. Only 2/3 of the required money was gathered, and the parents were going to try to borrow the rest, but Satan furnished it. He told us privately there was no purgatory, but he had contributed in order that Nicholas's parents and their friends might be saved from worry and distress. We thought it very good of him, but he said money cost him nothing. At the graveyard, the body of little Lisa was seized for debt by a carpenter to whom the mother owed 50 groschen for work done the year before. She had never been able to pay this and was not able now. The carpenter took the corpse home and kept it for a few days in his cellar, the mother weeping and imploring about his house all the time. Then he buried it in his brother's cattle yard without religious ceremonies. It drove the mother wild with grief and shame, and she forsook her work and went daily about the town cursing the carpenter and blaspheming the laws of the emperor and the church, and it was pitiful to see. Seppi asked Satan to interfere, but Satan said the carpenter and the rest were members of the human race and were acting quite neatly for that species of animal. He would interfere if he found a horse acting in such a way, and we must inform him if we were to come across that kind of horse doing that sort of human thing, so that he could stop it. We believe this was sarcasm, for of course, there was no such horse. After a few days, we found that we could not abide that poor woman's distress, so we begged Satan to examine her several possible timelines to see if he could not change her to her profit, to a new one. He said the longest of her careers gave her 42 years to live, and her shortest, 29, and that both were charged with grief and hunger and cold and pain. The only improvement he could make would be to enable her to skip a certain 3 minutes from now, and asked us if he should do it. This was a short time to decide, in that we went to pieces with nervous excitement, and before we could pull ourselves together and ask for particulars, he said the time would be up in a few more seconds, so we gasped out, "Do it!" "It is done," he said. "She was going around a corner. I've turned her back. It has changed her life." "Then what will happen, Satan?" we asked. "It's happening now. She is having words with Fisher, the weaver. In his anger, Fisher will straightaway do what he would not have done but for this accident. He was present when she stood over her child's body and uttered those blasphemies." "What will he do?" we asked. "He's doing it now, betraying her. In 3 days, she will go to the stake." We could not speak. We were frozen with horror. For if we had not meddled with her life, she would have been spared this awful fate. Satan noticed these thoughts and said, "What you are thinking is strictly human-like, that is to say, foolish. The woman is advantaged. Die when she might, she would go to heaven. By this prompt death, she gets 29 years more of heaven than she's entitled to, and escapes 29 years of misery." A moment before, we were bitterly making up our minds that we would ask no more favors of Satan's for friends of ours, for he did not seem to know any way to do a person a kindness but by killing him. But the whole aspect of the case was changed now, and we were glad of what we had done and full of happiness in the thought of it. After a while, I began to feel troubled about Fisher and asked timidly, "Does this episode change Fisher's life, Satan?" "Change it? Why, certainly, and radically. If he had not met Frau Brandt a while ago, he would die next year, 34 years of age. Now he will live to be 90 and have a prosperous and comfortable life of it, as human lives go." We felt a great joy and pride in what we had done for Fisher, and were expecting Satan to sympathize with this feeling. But he showed no sign, and this made us uneasy. We waited for him to speak, but he didn't. So, to assuage our solicitude, we had to ask him if there was any defect in Fisher's good luck. Satan considered the question for a moment, then said with some hesitation, "Well, the fact is, it is a delicate point. Under his several former life careers, he was going to heaven." We were aghast, then asked, "And under this one?" Satan replied, "Don't be so distressed. You were sincerely trying to do him a kindness. Let that comfort you." "That cannot comfort us," we said. "You ought to have told us what we were doing, then we wouldn't have acted so." It made no impression on him. We tried to make him see that he was missing the point entirely, but it all went for nothing. He said he did not care for Fisher. There were plenty more Fishers. The next minute, Fisher went by on the other side of the street, and it made us faint to see him, remembering the doom that was upon him, and we the cause of it. You could see by his elastic step and his alert manner that he was well satisfied with himself for doing that hard turn for poor Frau Brandt. He kept glancing back over his shoulder expectantly, and sure enough, pretty soon, Frau Brandt followed after, in charge of the officers and wearing jingling chains. A mob was in her wake, jeering and shouting, "Blasphemer and heretic!" And some among them were neighbors and friends of her happier days. Some were trying to strike her, and the officers were not taking as much trouble as they might to keep them from it. "Stop them, Satan!" It was out before we remembered that he could not interrupt them for a moment. without changing their whole lives. He puffed a little puff toward them with his lips, and they began to reel and stagger and grab at the empty air. Then they broke apart and fled in every direction, shrieking as if in intolerable pain. He had crushed a rib of each of them with that little puff. We could not help asking if their lives were changed. Yes, entirely. Some have gained years, some have lost, some few will profit in various ways by the changes, but only a few. We didn't ask if we had brought poor Fisher's luck to any of them. We didn't want to know. We fully believed in Satan's desire to do us kindnesses, but we were losing confidence in his judgment. It was at this time that our growing anxiety to have him look over our life charts and suggest improvements began to fade out and gave place to other interests. For a day or two, the whole village was a chattering turmoil over Frau Brandt's case and over the mysterious calamity that had overtaken the mob. And at her trial, the place was crowded. She was easily convicted of her blasphemies, for she uttered those terrible words again and said she would not take them back. When warned that she was imperiling her life, she said they could take it. She would rather live with the professional devils in perdition than these imitators in the village. They accused her of breaking all those ribs by witchcraft and asked her if she was not a witch. She answered scornfully, "No. If I had that power, would any of you holy hypocrites be alive for 5 minutes? No, I would strike you all dead. Pronounce your sentence and let me go. I am tired of your society." So they found her guilty, and she was excommunicated. Then she was clothed in a coarse robe and delivered to the secular arm and conducted to the marketplace, the bell solemnly tolling all the while. We saw her chained to the stake and saw the first thin film of blue smoke rise in the still air. Then her hard face softened, and she looked upon the packed crowd in front of her and said, with gentleness, "We played together once, when we were innocent little creatures. For the sake of that memory, I forgive you." We went away then and did not see the fires consume her, but we heard the shrieks although we put our fingers in our ears. When they ceased, we knew she was in heaven, notwithstanding the excommunication, and we were glad of her death and not so sorry that we had brought it about. One day, a little while after this, Satan appeared again. We were always watching out for him, for life was never stagnant when he was around. He came upon us at the place in the woods where we had first met him. And being boys, we wanted to be entertained. We asked him to do a show for us. "Very well," he said. "Would you like to see a history of the progress of the human race? Its development of that product which it calls civilization?" We said we would. So, with a thought, he turned the place into the Garden of Eden, and we saw Abel praying by his altar. Then Cain came walking toward him with his club. He spoke to his brother in a language which we didn't understand. Then he grew violent and threatening. We knew what was going to happen and turned our heads for a moment, but we heard the crash of the blows and heard the shrieks and the groans. Then there was silence, and we saw Abel dying in his blood and gasping out his life, and Cain standing over him, looking down at him, vengeful and unrepentant. Then the vision vanished and was followed by a long series of unknown wars, murders, and massacres. Next we had Sodom and Gomorrah and the attempt to discover two or three respectable persons there, as Satan described it. Next, Lot and his daughters in the cave. Next came the Hebraic Wars, and we saw the victors massacre the survivors and their cattle and save the young girls alive and distribute them around. Next we had Egyptian Wars, Greek Wars, Roman Wars, hideous drenching of the earth with blood. And we saw the treacheries of the Roman toward the Carthaginians and the sickening spectacle of the massacre of those people. Also, we saw Caesar invade Britain. Not that those barbarians had done him any harm, but because he wanted their land and desired to confer the blessings of civilization upon their widows and orphans, as Satan explained. Next, Christianity was born. Then ages of Europe passed in review before us, and we saw Christianity and civilization march hand in hand through those ages, leaving famine, death, and destruction in their wake, and other signs of the progress of the human race, as Satan observed. And always we had wars, and more wars, and still other wars, all over Europe, all over the world. Sometimes in the private interest of royal families, Satan said, sometimes to crush a weak nation, but never a war started by the aggressor for any clean purpose. There is no such war. Now, said Satan, you have seen your progress down to the present, and you must confess that it is wonderful in its way. We must now exhibit the future. He showed us slaughters more terrible in their destruction of life, more devastating in the engines of war than any we had ever seen. You perceive, he said, that you have made continual progress. Cain did his murder with a club. The Hebrews did their murders with javelins and swords, and Greeks and Romans added armor and the fine arts of military organization and generalship. The Christian has added guns and gunpowder. A few centuries from now, he will have so greatly improved the deadly effectiveness of his weapons of slaughter that all men will confess that without Christian civilization, war must have remained a poor and trifling thing to the end of time. Then he began to laugh in a most unfeeling way and make fun of the human race. Although he knew what he was saying shamed and wounded us, no one but an angel could have acted so. More than once, Seppi and I tried in a humble and diffident way to convert him, but it had no effect. So we kept the grief to ourselves, knowing that this was not the time to continue our work. Satan laughed his unkind laugh to a finish. Then he said, it's a remarkable progress. In 5 or 6,000 years, 5 or 6 high civilizations have risen, flourished, commanded the wonders of the world, then faded out and disappeared. And not one of them, except the latest, ever invented any sweeping and adequate way to kill people. They all did their best to kill, being the chiefest ambition of the human race and the earliest incident in its history, but only the Christian civilization has scored a triumph to be proud of. 2 or 3 centuries from now, it will be recognized that all the competent killers are Christians. Then the pagan world will school with the Christians, not to acquire his religion, but his guns. The Turk and the Chinaman will buy those to kill missionaries and converts. By this time, his theater was at work again, and before our eyes, nation after nation drifted by during 2 or 3 centuries, an endless procession, raging, struggling, wallowing through seas of blood, smothered in battle smoke through which the flags glinted and the red jets from the cannons darted. And always, we heard the thunder of the guns and the cries of the dying. And what does this amount to? Said Satan, with all his evil chuckle. Nothing at all. You gain nothing. You always come out where you went in. For 1,000,000 years, the race has gone on, monotonously propagating itself and monotonously reperforming this dull nonsense. To what end? No wisdom can guess. Who gets profit of it? Nobody but a parcel of usurping little monarchs and nobilities who despise you and would feel defiled if you touched them, would shut the door in your face if you proposed to call, whom you slave for, fight for, die for, and are not ashamed of it, but proud, whose existence is a perpetual insult to you, and you are afraid to resent it. These mendicants supported by your alms, yet assume toward you the airs of a benefactor toward the beggar, who address you in the language of master to slave, and are answered in the language of slave to master, who are worshipped by you with your mouth, while in your heart, if you have one, you despise yourselves for it. The first man was a hypocrite and a coward, qualities which have not yet failed in his line. It's the foundation upon which all civilizations have been built. Drink to their perpetuation. Drink to their augmentation. Drink to... Then he saw by our faces how much we were hurt, and he cut a sentence short and stopped laughing. And his manner changed, and he said gently, "No, let's drink to one another's health, and let civilization go." It was wonderful, the mastery that Satan had over time and distance. For him, they didn't exist. He called them human inventions and said they were artificialities. We often went to the most distant parts of the globe with them and stayed weeks and months And yet, we're gone only a fraction of a second, as a rule. One day, when our people were in such an awful distress because the Witch Commission were afraid to proceed against the astrologer in Father Peter's household, or against any, indeed, but the poor and the friendless, they lost patience and took the witch-hunting on their own score, and began to chase a born lady who was known to have the habit of curing people by devilish arts, such as bathing them, washing them, and nourishing them, instead of bleeding them and purging them in the proper way. She came flying down the hill, the howling and cursing mob after her, and tried to take refuge in the houses, but the doors were shut in her face. They chased her more than half an hour, and we followed to see it, and at last she was exhausted and fell, and they caught her. They dragged her to a tree and threw a rope over her limb and began to make a noose in it, some holding her meantime, and she crying and begging, and her young daughter looking on and weeping, but afraid to say or do anything. They hanged the lady, and I threw a stone at her, although in my heart I was sorry for her. But all were throwing stones, and each was watching his neighbor, and if I had not done as the others, it would have been noticed and spoken of. Satan burst out laughing. All that were nearby turned upon him, astonished and not pleased. It was an ill time to laugh, for his free and scoffing ways and his supernatural music had brought him under suspicion all over town and turned many privately against him. The big blacksmith called attention to him now, raising his voice so that all should hear, and said, "What are you laughing at? Please explain to the company why you threw no stone." "Are you sure I didn't throw a stone?" "You needn't try to get out of it. I had my eye on you." "And I too," shouted two others. "Three witnesses," said Satan. "Mueller, the blacksmith, Klein, the butcher's man, Pfeiffer, the weaver's journeyman. Three very ordinary liars. Are there any more?" "Never mind whether there's others or not, and never mind about what you consider us. Three's enough to settle your matter for you. You'll prove that you threw a stone, or it shall go hard with you." "That's so," shouted the crowd, and surged up as closely as they could to the center of interest. "And first, you will answer the other question," cried the blacksmith, pleased with himself for being mouthpiece to the public and hero of the occasion. "What are you laughing at?" Satan smiled and answered pleasantly, "To see three cowards stoning a dying lady when they are so near to death themselves." You could see the superstitious crowd shrink back, catch their breath under the sudden shock. The blacksmith, with a show of bravado, said, "What do you know about it?" "I? Everything. By profession, I'm a fortune teller. I read the hands of you three and some others when you lifted them to stone the woman. One of you will die tomorrow week. Another of you will die tonight. The third has but 5 minutes to live. And yonder is the clock." It made a sensation. The faces of the crowd blanched and turned mechanically toward the clock. The butcher and the weaver seemed smitten with an illness, but the blacksmith braced up and said with spirit, "It's not long to wait for your prediction number one. If it fails, young master, you will not live a whole minute after. I promise you that." No one said anything. All watched the clock in a deep stillness, which was impressive. When 4.5 minutes were gone, the blacksmith gave a sudden gasp and clapped his hands over his heart, saying, "Give me breath, give me room," and began to sink down. The crowd surged back, no one offering to support him, and he fell lumbering to the ground and was dead. The people stared at him, then at Satan, then at one another, and their lips moved, but no words came. Then Satan said, "Three saw that I threw no stone. Perhaps there are others. Let them speak." It struck a kind of panic into them, and although no one answered him, many began to violently accuse one another, saying, "You said he didn't throw. It's a lie, and I'll make you eat it." And so in a moment, they were in a raging and noisy turmoil, and beating and banging one another, and in the midst was the only indifferent one, the dead lady hanging from a rope, her troubles forgotten, her spirit at peace. So we walked away, and I was not at ease, but was saying to myself, "He told them he was laughing at them, but it was a lie. He was laughing at me." That made Satan laugh again, and he said, "Yes, I was laughing at you, because in fear of what others might report about you, you stoned the woman when your heart revolted the act. But I was laughing at the others, too." "Why?" "Because their case was yours." "How's that?" "Well, there were 68 people there. 62 of them had no more desire to throw a stone than you. I know your race. It's made up of sheep. It's governed by minorities, seldom or never by majorities. It suppresses its feelings and its beliefs and follows the handful that makes the most noise. Sometimes the noisy handful is right, sometimes wrong, but no matter, the crowd follows. The vast majority of the race, whether savage or civilized, are secretly kind-hearted and shrink from inflicting pain. but in the presence of the aggressive and pitiless minority, they don't dare to assert themselves. Think of it. One kind-hearted creature spies upon another and sees to it that he loyally helps in iniquities which revolt both of them. Speaking as an expert, I know that 99 out of 100 of your race were strongly against the killing of witches when that foolishness was first agitated by a handful of pious lunatics in the long ago. And I know even today, after ages of transmitted prejudice and silly teaching, only one person in 20 puts any real heart to the harrying of a witch. And yet apparently everybody hates witches and wants them killed. Someday a handful will rise up on the other side and make more noise. Perhaps even a single daring man with a big voice and a determined will. And in a week, all the sheep will wheel and follow him, and the witch hunting will come to an end. Monarchies, aristocracies, and religions are all based on that large defect in your race. The individual's distrust of his neighbor and his desire for safety or comfort's sake to stand well in his neighbor's eye. These institutions will remain and always flourish and always oppress you, affront you, and degrade you, because you will always be and remain slaves of minorities. There never was a country where the majority of the people were in their secret hearts loyal to any of these institutions. I didn't like to hear our race called sheep and said I didn't think we were. Still, it's true, lamb, said Satan. Look at you in war. What mutton you are, and how ridiculous. In war? How? There's never been a just one, never an honorable one, on the part of the instigator of the war. I could see a million years ahead, and this rule will never change in so many as half a dozen instances. The loud little handful, as usual, will shout for the war. The pulpit will, warily and cautiously, object at first. The great big dull bulk of the nation will rub its sleepy eyes and try to make out why there should be a war, and will say earnestly and indignantly, "It is unjust and dishonorable, and there is no necessity for it." The handful will shout louder. A few fair men on the other side will argue and reason against the war with speech and pen. And at first will have a hearing and be applauded, but it will not last long. Those others will outshout them, and presently the anti-war audiences will thin out and lose popularity. Before long you will see this curious little thing, the speaker stoned from the platform, and free speech strangled by hordes of furious men who in their secret hearts are still at one with those stone speakers as earlier, but do not dare say so. And now the whole nation, pulpit and all, will take up the war cry and shout itself hoarse and mob any honest man who ventures to open his mouth. And presently, such mouths will cease to open. Next, the statesman will invent cheap lies, putting the blame upon the nation that is attacked, and every man will be glad of those conscience-soothing falsities and will diligently study them and refuse to examine any refutations of them. And this he will, by and by, convince himself that the war is just and will thank God for the better sleep he enjoys after this process of grotesque self-deception. Listening to Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger, right here on The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston. We'll continue with our story next week.
Thanks to my friend Scooter for the reading of Mark Twain's posthumously published work, written in 1916, totally relevant 90 years later. This and all our other shows are available in MP3 at our website, unwelcomeguests.org, from whence you can also send us an email. Our theme music is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.